Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Marnie Vandenberg from New Orleans by way of Houston, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome, folks, to the Tennis Podcast, introduced beautifully there by Marnie Vandenberg from New Orleans by way of Houston, which, help me out here, David, I think means originally from New Orleans, currently in Houston, or is it the other way around? SOS.
I am going to pass that over to Matt, because I don't know either. All I know is that this was a birthday present from Marnie's husband, Edwin. And very nice thing to do from lovely Edwin for lovely Marnie. So thank you so much. But Matt, come on, correct our grammar for us.
It's not grammar.
Okay.
What a hospital pass of an opening question. I think from New Orleans, but currently in Houston.
Right.
Is that what you said?
Maybe it is grammar. I don't know. Linguistics. Yes. Well, wherever you are, Marnie, thank you very much. Beautiful intro there. If you'd like to get yourself an intro for 2024, then slots will become available in December. Watch this space, folks. Just another bit of housekeeping before we get going. If you're a friend of the Tennis Podcast, and why wouldn't you be, quite frankly, you can enter a prize draw to be in with the chance of winning semi-final tickets to the Davis Cup Finals in Malaga on Saturday, the 25th of November. Optional possibility of bumping into Matt, because he will be there as well. The winner gets a pair of tickets plus two nights accommodation and return flights to Malaga from any EU or UK airport. You, if you're a friend, have until Thursday, the 26th of October, at 11:59 p.m. UK time to enter. That's this coming Thursday. The link to do so for friends will be in our newsletter this week. And if you're a friend who doesn't get the newsletter, you know what I think of you, but also write to us, friends@tennispodcast.net, and we will send you the link. We'll also send the link to anyone who becomes a friend between now and the deadline on Thursday. And of course, before the Davis Cup Finals, it is the Billie Jean King Cup Finals. We've already run a competition for tickets to that, won by the brilliantly named Penny Powers. Hello, Penny. If you'd like to buy tickets to the Billie Jean King Cup Finals from the 7th to the 12th of November in Seville, of course, the link to book them is in our show notes. And we have a 2-for-1 ticket offer available for friends of the Tennis Podcast. We were looking this week. Tickets are really reasonably priced, aren't they, for the Billie Jean King Cup Finals. If you're thinking about going, or if you're thinking maybe possibly about going, having a look, do have a look, because I'm sure it'd be a good time and it would be cool to support that event, I think. So, all of the info is in our show notes, as always. That's the housekeeping over and done with. How are we, David? How are you?
I'm very well. I've had a fantastic week, to be honest. But going off to Shrewsbury with the two of you, and we had an eventful time. More of that later. I very, very much enjoyed it. And I've actually really enjoyed the weekend of tennis that I've come back to as well, because I think there's just been some brilliant finals and some very different types of finals. And I found it easier to to follow with the combination of tennis in Asia and the tennis in Europe across the board. There's been, any time of the day, there's been some tennis on, pretty much. And a lot of it's been good. So I've really enjoyed it.
Seeing as David has teased our Shrewsbury Tales, shall we just get that out of the way, Matt? Do you want to tell everybody how close we came to, well, frankly, all of us relocating to a short strip of B Road in the Shropshire countryside forevermore? quite close. We're all very grateful not to be on that flooded stretch of B Road right now, aren't we?
Yes, I think we all heard the rain in the night and were expecting to wake up to being flooded in, and that is pretty much what happened. We were told that to get out of our Airbnb, we had to turn right instead of left because left was flooded. So we went right, and my God, I do not want to know what left was like, because right was absolutely apocalyptic. We drove through a river. David went first in his big car, and it was dicey. Catherine and I were behind watching and decided that we needed to pause and sort of regroup before taking on that river. We did. Catherine, you had the triangle of doom in your car. The warning lights came on. It was an entire situation. But having made it through that, we thought, right, okay, we're through the worst of it now. And then we came across like an actual river that was flowing. And we took about 20 minutes before passing that. And it was only the bold van driver coming towards us that I think convinced us that it was even possible. Without him, we might still be there. We were in, quote, rescue territory, as you said. But we did go for it, mounting the right side of the curb and just putting the foot on the accelerator and hoping for the best. And then we ended up in a little place called Much Wenlock, where there was only one place open in the entire little village. And we regrouped and had a lovely, much-needed cooked breakfast in there. But it was a eventful hour or so. Yes.
Yeah, it felt like a sort of really low rent episode in Lord of the Rings, like a very sort of parochial chapter in Lord of the Rings. The sort of, we've just got to get to Much Wenlock. We've just got to get to this mythical place called Much Wenlock, and then all will be okay. Like our own personal what's it called? The Prancing Pony, wasn't it? Anyway, we are once again bogged down in that quagmire. Let's talk about tennis, shall we? And let's start in Tokyo. The ATP 500 event won by Ben Shelton, his first ATP Tour title, beating Aslan Karatsev 7-5, 6-1 in the final. Prior to that, he had won a match 7-6 in the third. In the first round against Taro Daniel, came from a set down to beat Jordan Thompson in round two, and came back from a set and 5-2 double breakdown to beat Marcus Giron in the semi-finals. This was some week from Ben Shelton, a real demonstration of his competitive fire and freshness and hunger for the tour. And that is always so fantastic to see, but at this time of the year, David, it's particularly fantastic to see, isn't it, when there are so many jaded faces around.
If you consider a year ago, he had never left the United States of America in his life before, and we had him turn up in Australia. We'd heard of him as a college player with promise, and people were excited about him, but I still was taken aback when he informed us that he'd never left the United States and he'd had to get a passport just to go to Australia to compete in the Australian Open, to which he got to the quarterfinals. To now be here 10 months on, winning this title in Tokyo, which is a difficult time zone from many of the others that they go to. The whole Asian swing is, I've heard players say that, particularly with China having not hosted events the last few years, the trip has taken its toll on many of the players because they're just not used to it. And he is a novice at this level. And here he is just sort of working his way through matches. And in that semi-final that you referenced against Garone, I mean, he's on the brink of defeat and he looks exhausted. He looks like he's hit the wall. And frankly, you would expect him to, given the amount he's put in over the course of the year. And he found a way to win. I mean, he was not playing that well. Garone was playing brilliantly. In Shelton's words, he was waxing me from the baseline. And so what did Shelton do? He just started charging the net every single point. And eventually, Garone kind of capitulated, kind of beat himself. And I mean, because Shelton wasn't even smashing the serve down. He was kind of swinging it out wide and coming in, playing the left-handed volley off the swinging serve. And it worked for him. And then in the final, he was a different player altogether. Suddenly, the freshness was back. It was like the end is in sight. Okay, let's just put the foot down all the way, give whatever I've got left. And frankly, he really outplayed Karatsev, who was terrible in the second set. I mean, nigh on tanking, really. Just certainly not the player that had got him to the final, because Karatsev had been excellent. I'd have made Karatsev favourite for that final, given what I'd seen to that point. And the fact that Shelton won it, the age he is, the experience he's had, the lack of experience he's had, I think is really impressive.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know what you think, Matt, but I really think that the context of Ben Shelton's season is so important to really highlight what a big deal this win is, because he's pretty much done nothing on tour this season. His season has been two results. It's been quarterfinals at the Australian Open and semifinals at the US Open. Two ridiculous, incredible results that are, you know, given the status of those tournaments, those results in themselves are enough to indicate his potential and to herald an incredible breakthrough year on the ATP tour. But at lower levels, he's done nothing. It's been a fact-finding mission and little else for him. It's been kind of a, you know, he talked, didn't he, earlier in the summer about how when he went on the European swing earlier, he was kind of a bit of a tourist, you know, a real, you know, guy with a passport for the first time vibes. So for him to be winning a 500 level title is a massive milestone. And even given the time of year it's coming, all the caveats that we always put at results at this time of year, and, you know, the fact that nothing is guaranteed, I think this is a really, really big deal and incredibly impressive from Ben Shelton.
Yeah, I completely agree. I didn't really have any particularly high hopes for his post-US Open end to the season, just because of exactly what you'd said. What he'd done on the tour this season, he wasn't pulling up trees. I thought, you know, even if he did nothing after the US Open, it would still be a really impressive first season on the tour, finding his feet, showing that he's got a big game that can do damage at the biggest tournaments. And then maybe next year would be the year where he would, you know, start to build some consistency on the tour. This little run he's put together in Tokyo, winning the title, has come way quicker than I would have expected. And I mean, he did actually credit the fact that he didn't have any runs on the tour through the season as to one of the reasons why he is still fresh. You know, because he hasn't played as many matches as players who, you know, consistently have been winning two or three matches at each tournament. You know, he's been fatigued, I suppose, by the experience of being on tour for the first time. But it's not like he's got many matches in his legs this season. He is perhaps a bit fresher at this time of the year compared to a lot of the others because of his, you know, his poor results on the tour generally this year. But I think also there is just a freshness and an energy to him that he seems to have above the rest of the field. You know, we think of so many tennis players as being a little bit jaded, and it's kind of a secret weapon for Ben Shelton that he is embracing and absolutely loving this first year on tour. And I've been so impressed by his adaptability, as kind of David was alluding to there. You know, he realized that he needed to mix that up against Garone. You know, that it wasn't sustainable. He wasn't going to win that match unless he changed his tactics. And, you know, he started net rushing and shortening the points. And I've also been impressed with his rally tolerance a lot over the past couple of weeks. When he beat Sinner the other week, I was really impressed that he was kind of prepared to go toe-to-toe with him rather than just think, I need to hit him off the court. He seems to have different ways to win. And I think being one-dimensional is such a block for so many players. And he seems to not be that at all. And yeah, in the final, his lefty serve just gave Karatsev absolute fits. I remember watching them play at the US Open, and I think that was the match where Shelton got his serve up to the high 140s, and Karatsev didn't like it that day, and he did not enjoy it again. It's such a weapon that he's got. It's all coming together for Ben Shelton, and it's great to see. He's a real breath of fresh air.
Yeah, there was a point when Karatsev went an early breakdown in that second set of the final where he basically decided, well, I'm never going to beat this guy. I can't handle this lefty serve. I'm checking out here. I thought it was a bit poor, actually, the latter stages of that match from Aslan Karatsev. I know demeanour-wise, there's not a ton of difference between Aslan Karatsev tanking and Aslan Karatsev putting in full effort. So it's possibly difficult to pinpoint exactly where on that scale he was, but I would hazard that it wasn't full effort. But that's because Shelton had beaten him by that point. He'd worn him down and didn't let him get a foothold in the match, didn't let him develop any rhythm. You know, when Karatsev's in a rhythm, he's one of those ping-pong players. It just, you feel like the ball is trampolining out of the middle of the racket the whole time, and his rally tolerance is just 10 out of 10. You know, he's not going to miss. And Shelton never allowed him to get into that kind of rhythm. And on the variety, some players with variety, you feel like it almost bamboozles them. You know, when the A game isn't working, they kind of hit the panic button and throw all their other tricks at the wall in a slightly haphazard kind of way. He seems to have the right instincts for when to deploy things. I love his net rushing, his chipping and charging almost. And, you know, it's not, he doesn't win the point 100% of the time, but I rarely think, no, that was the wrong play there, Ben. As if I've got any authority to be saying that to Ben Shelton. But I think you get the point that I'm making. I would like to talk, please, about El Race for a minute.
Sure.
People have been shitting the bed in El Race. That's yes. My analysis.
Well, given that, Matt, look, only 8 qualify and Ben Shelton is in 14th position. I'm not talking about any likely scenarios here. I'm talking about the fact that Shelton, in his own words, is fresher than anybody, really. He's got more in the canister for the year than anybody else has. And there are still a lot of points on offer before El Race is decided. There is Vienna, which is a 500, and there is Paris, which is a 1,000. And Ben Shelton, I know they're both stacked draws. Ben Shelton is a contender in both of those events. And in the eloquent words of Matt Roberts, people are shitting the bed left, right and centre in this race. So you've got, I mean, everybody down to, I mean, I don't think Rublev is officially qualified, is he? But he's going to qualify. Rublev in 5th position on 4,275 points. Then you've got Tsitsipas in 6th. On 3,700 points. Then Zverev, 3,400. Runa, 3,100. Fritz, who looks just gone to me. He lost to a player that we're going to talk about in a minute, Shintaro Mochizuki, earlier in the week. And he looked pretty hollow, I thought. Then Casper Ruud, 2,800. Then Hubert Hurkacz, 2,700. Or to approaching 2,800, then Tommy Paul, then Alex de Minaur, then Ben Shelton. I know that's a lot of names, but if you're in Ben Shelton's mind right now, you're thinking about El Race, right? And you're thinking about Turin.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. I mean, there is a big obstacle in his way this week, which is, you know, doing that journey from Tokyo back to Europe, and then he's got Jannik Sinner waiting for him in the first round of that tournament. I mean, that's a bit of a nightmare, and I do think he's gonna need pretty much all the points he can possibly muster to to put himself in a position to actually qualify for Turin. So I still think it's an outside, a very, very long outside shot. But yeah, of course, I think he's got his sights set on it. But I wouldn't be predicting it. I just think there's a little bit too much still to do for him. And yeah, it's just a bit of a nightmare draw for him in Vienna.
David, you love an outlandish prediction. It's something that everyone in Shrewsbury this week can attest to.
I was on form.
Who do you think is going to get the last Turin spot?
Well, not Ben Shelton, in all honesty, because I think he's going to hit the wall. And I just don't see how you do that trip with that jet lag and get to Vienna and beat Jannik Sinner. I can't see that happening. And I think that may be the best we see of him this year now. I'm not sure that he'll have much of a run at either of these two events. He's certainly capable, because indoors, I think, suits him. I think, frankly, pretty much anything except clay suits him, really. But so hold on, who's under Rublev at five, are the other three up for grabs, the other three spots?
Yeah. I mean, people would need to do serious stuff in the remaining events. But as I said, there are enough points still on offer. You know, someone wins Paris, that's 1,000 points.
I think the most likely to come from the outside the current spots and get in is probably Hurkacz. In that he's displayed some good form recently, obviously winning Shanghai. He then lost his first match after that, but you know, that was just off the back of winning a big title. I think Hurkacz indoors, he's playing Basel, which is a slightly weaker field compared to Vienna. And then Paris. Yeah, I could see him making up the points on Runa, who's currently in that eighth spot. And I think Tsitsipas and Zverev will probably hang on and qualify, because yeah, as you said, Fritz looks gone. Ruud has not played well for a while. Runa's interesting. There's obviously the Boris Becker of it all that I'm sure we'll come on to. If he can ignite, then he's in a strong position, because he's ahead of Hurkacz. But I just got a feeling that Hurkacz might put a run together at either Basel or Paris and sort of sneak in.
Yeah.
My predictions are terrible, so that's probably wrong.
Well, but I think of all of them, he's the one I'd probably go for as well, because he's got 500 points looking at this on Shelton, three places below him. And the ones above him, Ruud and Fritz, I don't feel hugely convinced by them either. And I just... The game seems to be coming quite easy to Hurkacz generally at the moment, and the opposite is true of Fritz.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. He loves it indoors. Had some good results in Paris, hasn't he, Hurkacz? Watch this space. We'll keep you posted on El Race. Just before we move on to the other results from the week, a quick word on Shintaro Mochizuki, who was somebody that came to our attention while we were watching him beat Taylor Fritz in that cottage in the middle of nowhere in Shropshire. And we all just instantly fell in love with him. We had one of those, oh, this is the best player in the world moments. Where's he been? these were his first ever ATP Tour match wins, weren't they, in the opening round, and then in the second round to beat Taylor Fritz, love 6-6, 4-7, 6, backed it up, beating Alexei Popperin 7-5 in the third, in the quarters. He's not completely out of nowhere. He's a former junior number one, I think, 2019 Wimbledon boys champion. And of course, there's been a pandemic since then. You know, people's developments and transitions from juniors to seniors over the course of this period are, you know, it's expected that they would be non-smooth and non-traditional. So I don't think it's a, well, where have you been if you're that good question. I definitely think skill-wise, racket skill-wise, he is something to behold. Absolutely electric. It felt like he could put the ball anywhere on the court. It felt like, oh my God, I don't know what he's going to do with the ball here. This is so fun and exciting. His his stature is going to be a problem, isn't it? It's always, unfortunately, going to be an uphill battle for him. I think there's kind of a threshold at which your stature can not necessarily be a negative. I think in the men's game, it's probably about 5'10". But he's less than that, and he's very, very slight, isn't he? I'm sure he can put on a bit of muscle, but, you know, you've got the whole balance thing of there are benefits that come with his size as well. He's like a mosquito around the court. So maybe you just play to your strengths and know that, you know, you're not ever going to be Daniil Medvedev, or, you know, he's never going to be agricultural, is he? And I'm fascinated about, you know, what he can do with his career with those raw materials. And I'd like the answer to be a lot, because he is so fun.
Mm. Yeah, it's a really wonderful feeling when you just put tennis on and you're instantly sort of drawn to a player. And I think we all had that with Mochizuki. And one of the incredible things was the way he turned this match around. I mean, he lost that first set 6-love and said he was too nervous to swing and he was scared of missing. And then in the bit of the match that we saw, it was the complete opposite. He was embracing the crowd and going for his shots. And yeah, the way he was net rushing and taking the ball early and had good hands at the net. He was just so skilled, I think, was what really stood out. And I saw a video of him hitting with Federer at the 2019 ATP Finals. I think he sort of went along as one of the sort of practice hitting partners for the top players. So, you know, he really was, I think, you know, talked about and on the cusp of things in 2019, but it just hasn't happened for him. And you just hope that a week like this can be the breakthrough he needs, because, yeah, he's extremely entertaining player to watch. And the win over Fritz was something, but as you said, backing it up, I always think is such an impressive thing for a player to be able to do if they've just had a big win. And he did that against Popper in another really high quality match. Yeah. Really, really fun time watching him this week.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on to Antwerp, the ATP 250 there. It was won by Alexander Bublik. He beat Artifice 4-4 in the final. Ran out of steam, I think, Artifice. And also ran into an immovable object, quite frankly. Bublik was barely losing points on serve all week. When he hits a rhythm on that serve, it's pretty much unplayable. It's unbreakable. Fies had beaten Stefanos Tsitsipas, who, PS, won the doubles title with Petros. Congratulations to them. 7-6, 7-6 for Fies in the semis over Tsitsipas. My favourite thing about this finals day, David, was Ben Shelton's message to Artur Fies on the camera in Tokyo. Feed that into my veins.
Yes, because I think in the semi-finals, Fies had followed Shelton in writing "humble and hungry" on the lens, and so when Shelton won his title, he wrote "show me something, Arthur," and unfortunately, Arthur ran into Alexander Bublik and was unable to show him anything.
They both wrote "humble and hungry" on the camera, correct, after their semi-final victories.
Yes.
Now, obviously, I love that. Boys, don't listen to me. Write whatever you like on the camera. This is great fun. But just as a point of order, I do think humble is a descriptor that only third parties should be allowed to describe someone as. No one should ever be allowed to describe themselves as humble.
when you're 19 / 20, I don't think they know the meaning of the word.
Yeah, well, anyway,
but I absolutely take your point. But I mean, I tell you what, they both are to my eye anyway, is likable, and I just I do. They're the players I organise my day around. I will see them play any time of the day or night, because they're just great fun, and I don't know what's going to happen next. And And I think that they are getting a buzz out of each other and being a generation that's coming through. They played against each other in the Laver Cup. And yeah, I think they're enjoying each other's vibe. I think that they know each other has got game and that they could be a big part of each other's lives for the next 10 years. Got to say, though, Feast didn't get close, really, against Bublik. I mean, he'd never played him before, and you could tell that he just did not really know what is he doing down there. You know, I mean, he hit 11 aces and 11 double faults. And a lot of the double faults were coming off 130 mile an hour second serves, which he just decided not to get involved in rallies in, because that's one of the things that Bublik does. I mean, he hadn't won a match, I don't think, since Wimbledon. You know, until this tournament, and then suddenly he finds his range, playing indoors, and what a player he looks when he's like that. I mean, Fiese actually set up the same number of break points as Bublik in the match, but he lost 6-4, 6-4. And it was a perfect Bublik-style match. And I think they'll play again in the future, and particularly if they play, say, on clay or something like that. Fiese is going to wipe the floor with him at times, I think. But stick it on that surface indoors when Fiese has just not played anybody like that. He looked really, really new on the scene in that particular match.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say, we spoke the other day, didn't we, about the about that article that Gary Nathan wrote about Adrian Mannarino. What is Adrian Mannarino doing? And I think you could definitely, you know, reuse that title with what is Alexander Bublik doing, because his whole approach to tennis is quite perplexing, and he does just have, as David described, just spells of not winning matches at all, and then suddenly he won't just be a bit good, he'll go and win the tournament that he's playing and look sort of unplayable. And I think particularly on those quick surfaces, you know, grass courts and indoor hard courts are where he thrives. He's got such good hands. He can block returns, and he can fire aces. And yeah, he's an absolute nightmare when he's in that sort of form. But it wouldn't surprise me if we sort of don't mention Bublik now until, you know, February, when the indoor swing comes back round again. You know, it's just the pattern that he has.
The Stockholm title, ATP 250, won by Gael Monfils. He beat Pavel Kotov 4-6, 7-6, 6-3 in the final. I only need one, David. He only needs one.
Oh, Catherine. And I tell you, if you're going to watch, I mean, there's a couple of good candidates for watching the highlights of finals this week. If you're going to watch one match in highlight form, watch this one. I had the best 11 minutes of my weekend this morning just watching that. And I mean, it's one of those where you could convince yourself it's one of the matches of the year based on the 11 minutes. I don't know what was happening in the points in between the ones I saw, but the ones I saw, I mean, Kotov hits the ball so hard and so sweetly. Goodness me. And the retrieving of Monfils, the age he is just astonishing. And the fact that he turned that match around the way he did, I think at one stage it was maybe 5-all, love 40 on his serve in the second set when he's a set down. And he just dug himself out of trouble. And he willed himself to that title. And Kotov certainly showed talent. But Catherine, the I only need one line was in the celebration as well. I mean, I know this is a small event on the tour, but it's a very historic tournament, Stockholm. It's been around for years. But on the side of the court, you've got Mikael Tillström, a longtime coach of Monfils, tears in his eyes. You've got Elina Svitolina, his wife. He's got his family there. They're all just so emotional watching him do this. And it was beautiful watching him hold that trophy again.
What I really loved about this is something you hinted at there, David, was that this was a win in Gael Monfils' image still. You know, he was scrambling, he was defending, and I think a lot of the time people have actually urged him not to play that way, you know, and try and shorten the points and, you know, not have to rely on his incredible athleticism. But it's what he always falls back on. It is sort of his DNA as a tennis player to play like that. And what I thought was so interesting about that is that He's the fourth player now since 1990, aged 37 or over, to win an ATP title. You know, it's a very small group of players who've had that success at the age that Monfils is now. The other three are Federer, Lopez and Karlovic, who can all just rely on their serve and keep points short and hit aces. And Monfils can't really do that. He's having to play in the way that he's always played. And I think it's pretty remarkable that he is still able to fall back on that. There were times this year where I really worried about his physicality. I remember when he came back in Indian Wells and he looked weak. He looked like all the muscle had just sort of gone from his legs, and he obviously sustained that injury as well over the summer. And yet, when he's been fit and when he's been healthy, he's played some really good tennis this year. And it was more of the same in Stockholm. He was playing at a really good level against a guy who, as David said, in Kotov. You know, normally when players hit the ball, it slows down a bit when the ball bounces because they put spin on it. When his ball hits the floor, it just accelerates through because he's hitting it so flat and so pure. And Monfils was having to be at his scrambling best. So yeah, it was a really good match, and yeah, just really special scenes for Monfils to win that title 12 years after he won it the last time.
He only needs one. On to the WTA. I'll be kind and not ask you the obvious Monfils question. Unless anybody would like to submit an answer voluntarily. No.
You wouldn't want to play him. I tell you, if you're Djokovic, you would. But if you're if you're Alcaraz or
But that is
Sinner,
a problem, isn't it?
Of course it is. He wants to be in the other half of the draw. But there's a number of the players who wouldn't want to play him. There's a lot of them that really wouldn't fancy that. If he gets inspired and if he's fully fit, he's still a problem for players. And yeah, I mean, I don't really think he'll ever beat Djokovic. I just don't see how that happens. But the rest of them, I think he can, on a given day, he can beat.
Okay. Like it. Told you he was in a punchy mood. It's the Shropshire effect.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
On to the WTA. They were all 250 events on that side of things this week. Elisa Mertens, the champion in Monastir, defending her title, beating Jasmine Paolini 6-3, 6-love in the final. Didn't drop a set all week, did Elise Mertens? She's just... It's so hard not to damn Elise Mertens by faint praise, isn't it? But well, someone save me from damning her with faint praise as I'm just about to. She's just always there, isn't she? Plugging away. There yeah. you go. I did it.
I mean, I'm afraid to say the words I were going to say were reliable and never lets you down. So, I mean, they're exactly the same type of phrases that you're using there because, well, I say that as a compliment because I have such respect for her. I do think she has a very, very clear ceiling with masses of data to show that she can't seem to break through it. And that's fourth round stroke quarterfinals at Grand Slams. And I think maybe she has reached one semi-final. I can't remember. But it's
Australia.
Just... that's it. But it just doesn't feel like that's ever going to happen. You know, I will never say Eliza Mertens is in the mix for a Grand Slam tournament. I will never say that in my lifetime. but
Ons Jabeur says hi.
Okay. I really say it this time.
Can you imagine if we're sitting here in 2 years' time with Eliza Mertens, a three-time Grand Slam finalist, ribbing
I will
David
own it,
for
Catherine.
His big Eliza Mertens diss.
She can come on here and give me the stick I deserve. But I actually love the way she approaches the sport. She just seems to enjoy the grind and the process. And here we are with her holding the trophy at this event.
In Nanchang, Katerina Siniakova, first and foremost, she got revenge over Leila Fernandez in the semi-finals, reversed their result from the previous week. And then in the final, beat Marie Buzkova 1-6, 7-6, 7-6 in the longest WTA final of 2023 at 3 hours and 33 minutes, which, given there was a 6-1 set in there, tells you, I think, everything you need to know about those two tiebreak sets. I don't know what to make of these results that Katerina Siniakova is having, because I remember a couple of years ago when Barbora Krejcikova was having her great success, I remember watching Siniakova and thinking, okay, take the serve out of it. The serve does make me anxious. That service motion, I mean, no one's teaching that, are they? It's not. You do hold your breath a bit. But from the back of the court, you think, wow, why aren't you doing better? And I thought with those raw materials and the inspiration of seeing what her doubles partner was achieving in singles, I sort of had one eye on her thinking, what's she going to do here? And she stayed exactly where she was. And I don't know enough about her to speculate about why that is. Maybe her game just wasn't up to, maybe her game had reached its ceiling. But again, with the caveat of the time of year it is and everything, these are really good results. These are really impressive results. And maybe it is a slightly delayed Krejcikova effect. I don't know. Maybe this is something she's had in her all along, and I gave up on her too quickly, Matt.
I don't know. I don't get the sense that Siniakova is going to go on a Krejcikova style ascension in singles. I've always thought that she kind of needed Krejcikova on the doubles court just to calm her down a bit. I mean, she is very much the, you know, the fire in the fire and ice of them on a doubles court. And I think as impressive as these 2 weeks have been, and look, I did not have watching Katerina Siniakova thrillers on my end of season bingo card, but I've been really enjoying her matches over the past couple of weeks. But they have kind of in a way been a bit too dramatic to be sustainable. Like, you just, if you're going to make real progress in singles, you need to be winning matches, I think, just a bit more efficiently. And I think it's really impressive, the sort of wins that they had, but they don't, to me, say that she's necessarily sort of changed or hugely gone up a level. But I've enjoyed them so much. And this final against Marie Buzkova, what impressed me here was, we were talking earlier about how Ben Shelton went from rallying with Marcus Giron to shortening the points. Well, Siniakova did the complete opposite in this match. In the first set, she was just hitting unforced errors and trying to keep the rally short, and it wasn't working. And then sort of halfway through the match, she decided, okay, this is going to be a grind, but I need to take Buzkova on at her own game. And suddenly she was moonballing and playing long rallies. There was a 44-shot rally at one point, and she just sort of went into the trenches and still had to save a match point in the second set, eventually took that set on her eighth set point, had to save two match points in the third set. And it was just high drama. And you just had this feeling that something dramatic was going to happen at the end as well. And then, of course, after over 3.5 hours, it ended on a dead net cord, which must just be absolutely soul-destroying for Marie Buzkova. But probably a little slice of luck that Siniaková deserved, having played so many sort of epics over the past couple of weeks. Yeah, she's been a really fun watch, but personally, I don't see a huge sort of jump in level or ranking coming. But it would be good, because she's a hell of a player. She's very fun to watch.
The WTA Transylvania Open was won by Tamara Korpač. She beat Elena Gabriela Rusa 6-3, 6-4 in the final to win her first WTA title. What are you finding funny about that, Matt?
Just the thought just, of Harmony Tan seething.
The mere mention of Tamara Korpač.
Apparently,
that's
Harmony
how to
Tan
be
also,
a professional, Harmony.
Harmony won an ITF event the same week. I actually watched the highlights of Korpač's run to the title, the sort of five matches she had, and I mean she just about made it to the quarterfinals. She was 5-1 down in the deciding set tiebreak to Jody Burridge at one stage, and then she had to win another grinding three setter as well. It was really impressive. My word, I think it's the first time I've really watched Korpač play. She absolutely leathers the ball. She does not hang around in rallies at all. And it was fun watching her suddenly ignite and just go and grab the title.
Yeah, absolutely. Congratulations to her. I want to bring you the result actually from the event that we were at last week doing our live show in Shrewsbury, the W100 event, ITF level women's event, won by the top seed, Victoria Golubic, love in the final over the British player Armani Banks. I mean, she was, as I say, the top seed and quite evidently a class apart from everybody else in the draw and also on the backhand list. Although, spoiler from the live show, Matt is considering bumping her off the backhand list. Is that right?
Somebody's
so
already gone.
Enjoy your love and love victory.
I was going to say, she survived the bumping off this week. I'm afraid that I have to update people on the backhand list. Those who are at the live show will know this, and friends who were watching will also know. But yes, Emma Raducanu, I'm afraid, is off the backhand list, and Elena Rybakina is on.
Is that just due to inactivity?
Slightly, and also just having watched Rybakina a lot this year, especially live, I think I've really been taken by that backhand. It's just become unavoidable to me. She needed to be on the list. It's smooth and it's powerful. It's a great combination. She's on the list, and yeah, I'm afraid Raducanu's off. It hurts me to bump someone off. I love all those backhands dearly, and Raducanu will be coming for I think Golubic's place on that list next year.
Yeah, there's been a lot of activity, hasn't there, around Emma Raducanu in the last couple of weeks. Her Instagram sort of gym training videos have stepped up a gear. It's clear she's, you know, she's working hard on that comeback and wants us to know she's working hard on that comeback. She also did a round of press this week here in the UK, gave some quotes that garnered quite a lot of attention to BBC Radio 4's Today programme, a very much listened to, high profile morning show here in the UK. She said she hopes to be back for the start of the new season. She said, I'm actually looking forward to starting again, kind of resetting. And on her coaching situation, she said, I ask my coaches a lot of questions. On certain occasions, they haven't been able to keep up with the questions I've asked. And maybe that's why it ended. It's something I've always done. I keep provoking and asking questions to coaches and challenging their thinking as well. I'm not someone that you can just tell me what to do and I'll do it. I need to understand why and then I'll do it. There's been a lot of negative reaction to those quotes. A lot of coaches or people associated with coaches have found them a bit sort of dismissive or disrespectful to the profession. And I do see that point of view. And obviously, you know, players do need to, show an amount of respect for what they're being told, whether they're agreeing with it or not. But I punched the air a bit when I heard that. There are far too many, and I don't blame the players for this. I blame the culture and the environment and lack of female coaches and all the rest of it. But there are too many female player, male coach, deferential relationships in this sport that make me wince. So to hear of a player exerting agency and curiosity and independence in that relationship, I find encouraging. I was really pleased to hear those comments. Whether you know, perhaps she, I don't know how she's doing it. You know, context is everything. I don't know what those conversations look like, and I suspect what they look and sound like has a lot of bearing on how, you know, how put out a coach might be on feeling it. But the principle of a player questioning what their coach is telling them like that, and not just wholesale expecting it and nodding along and doing what you're told submissively, I am so okay with that. All power to you, Emma.
I'm also okay with the idea of difference. Why does everybody have to have the same approach? I must have a coach and I must do exactly what they say. Okay, well, why? Let's see if there's another. If you're a different kind of person to that, and she's saying she is, then that's entirely up to her. Now, the test of time will come into this as well. If she can get fully fit, whether she feels she needs to adjust anything and whether that approach works and all those sort of things. But even just sort of philosophically, she's talking in a way there that is different. And I have no issue with that at all. I mean, that is how she lives her life and believes in her own mind and wants it to be kind of probed rather than just told what to do, and I think it's I get why coaches get wound up by it as well. I mean, but have some respect for her as well. Have some respect for the way that she wants to go about doing things, and the idea that coaches are not going to want to work with Emma Raducanu because she said these things or because she's not given a great degree of career expectancy, length of career with her because in the past, I just think is nonsense. It's like saying a football team, it's like saying Watford will never get another manager because they keep sacking them all. Well, they keep getting them, don't they? Because people want the jobs, and she's good enough and people will want to work with her. I'm quite convinced of that.
Yeah, when I heard these quotes, my mind went to the brilliant interview you did a few years ago, David, with Larry Stefanke, you know, sort of regarded as one of the best tennis coaches over the last few years. And I remember a point he made during that interview was that he always wanted input from his player. He didn't want a player who had no idea or no thoughts about their own game. You know, he wanted coaching to be a dialogue. And I think, you know, that to me suggests that Emma Raducanu is thinking about her own game and, you know, wanting input from a coach, but also sort of questioning it and challenging it and wanting it to be as best as it can possibly be. And I think yes, part of this is on Emma Raducanu to maybe commit a little bit longer to certain coaches. I do think there have been one or two that it's felt like have been dropped maybe a little bit too quickly. But it's also on those coaches to be, well, we can use that word, be humble and sort of appreciate that they need to sort of build a relationship with the player as well. And, you know, they might not have all the answers necessarily that they can help. And it's got to be a two-way thing. And I think if coaches are being absolutely put off by the fact that a player is slightly questioning what they're saying, then something there feels a little bit wrong to me. And I can't imagine that, for example, Andy Murray just takes everything that his coach possibly says to be, you know, fact. I'm sure Andy Murray would be questioning it as well. And maybe, as you say, it's just in the way that those conversations happen rather than necessarily the very fact of Emma Raducanu sometimes questioning the advice, because that to me sounds like a really healthy thing to be doing.
Mm, absolutely. You mentioned earlier the Aruna Becker bombshell is now confirmed. Becker told Eurosport in Germany that he'll work with Aruna for the rest of the season, starting in Basel, then Paris and hopefully Turin. He described Aruna as a rough diamond who needs polishing, and he said he felt proud to have been asked. Proof will be in the pudding, I guess. I mean, I
good
do...
Good for podcasters.
It's good for podcasters. I mean, Becker was the jolt for Djokovic, right? He was the icing on the cake. Runa's at a very different stage of his career. He needs more than that. So I don't know. I really don't. I don't know if this will work, but I'm interested. That's for sure. Yeah, well, let's watch this space. Speaking of Basel, Alcaraz was due to play. He's had to pull out with injury. He wrote on his Instagram, "I have a problem with the plantar fascia in my left foot and muscle fatigue in my lower back, which needs treatment so I can play for the rest of the season." Plantar fascia doesn't... that. I mean, if that's plantar fasciitis, which... I mean, we're about two letters away from the word plantar fasciitis there. That's not good. It's not, you know, career ending. It's not, but it's very much an ongoing thing. It's not something that you can get a bit of treatment for and be fine, or rest it for a week and it's fine. It's on the chronic end of things, and it's in a part of the body that you can't not use or use less or make any adaptations to. I mean, your foot is, it's very important to playing tennis, and I don't know, Carlos Alcaraz is just so integral to everything about men's tennis at the moment. He's integral to Djokovic. He's integral to every potential rivalry that we're touting. He's integral to all of the fun, kind of. And I shiver at the thought of him having a sustained injury, and I'm crossing fingers and toes and eyes that this this isn't something significant.
So are my predictions, Catherine.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have enough time to express all the feelings and thoughts that are going to be thrown up from this. But we had the news this week that Sabalenka, Jabeur, Djokovic and Alcaraz are all confirmed to play an exhibition in Saudi Arabia after Christmas this year. We've also had reports this week that the ATP is poised to announce that rumoured ATP 1000 event in Saudi Arabia starting in 2025. John Wertheim has been reporting this week that he had heard the WTA finals were confirmed for Saudi Arabia next year, and that was potentially something that was going to be announced during this year's finals. Again, none of this is confirmed, only this exhibition event for after Christmas is confirmed. We won't get into it now, but rest assured, Saudi Arabia is a topic that is going to come up a lot. And I suspect we'll be leading a fair few podcasts with it, and it'll get its fair chunk of airtime. So we'll just drop the news for now and leave it there. But rest assured, we're not ignoring the implications and ramifications. The doubles lineup for the WTA finals confirmed. Lara Siegmund and Vera Zvonareva secured the final spot there by winning Nan Chang. So that's Pegula Goff, Hunter Mertens, Krejcikova, Siniaková, Scherz and Kravchik, Aoyama, Shibahara, Dabrowski, Rautliff, and Melikar Martinez Perez. Joined by Laura Siegmund and Vera Zvonareva. The WTA is in Zhuhai this week, which is the tier below the WTA finals, the sort of sub-finals or plate. It's a sort of plate-type thing. And there are four groups there. There's the Azalea group, Krejcikova, Kazatkina, Linette, the Camellia group, Keys, Haddadmaier and Garcia, the Orchid group, Ostapenko, Vekic and Zheng, and the Rose group, Sansonima, Kudermetova and Zhu, who is a wild card. I'm sure Zhu, as a home player, will make it fun. Not sure how I feel about wild cards at an event of that type, but there we go. Round robins start on Tuesday. There's doubles there as well. And the men's tour this week is in Vienna and Basel. Basel round ones include Runa Ketsmanovic, Murray Hanfman, which is, I think, about to start, Diminor Schwartzman, Jari Mannarino. He's snuck Jari into the agenda again, guys. Jari Mannarino, Matt, sorry, is not a notable round one.
I respectfully disagree.
Right. Well, I've read it out now. And as the constructor of the agenda, it is your right to make that call. But I'm just flagging.
Look, it's
that your editorial judgment might be obscured by your love for Nicholas Jarry at this point.
Is there doubt over including Murray Hanfman?
I think the people listening care more about Murray Hanfman than they do about Jarry Mannarino.
The noise you've made about Andy Murray being a part of the Big Four, and now you're saying that he shouldn't be in if Nicholas Jarry's not in the agenda. Andy Murray will be more relevant until he retires than those two.
Every single round one match in Vienna is more relevant than that one. The round ones in Vienna are absolutely ridiculous. Medvedev Fis, Dimitrov Musetti, Tsitsipas Team, Tiafoe Evans and Shelton Sinner. I would happily watch all of those back to back. And ignore Nicholas Jarry against Adrian Mannarino. The WTA finals start on Sunday. We will have a preview show before then, don't you worry. So over the weekend, you'll be getting a preview show for that. Plans to record on Saturday, Matt. David will be on holiday, but we're hoping for a very special guest. I won't commit them now, but are we 90% confirmed for our very special guest, David, in your absence?
I'm going to go 78%
confirmed. 78% confirmed. Right. That's why we're not naming the very special guest. But yeah, we'll have a preview show on Saturday. David's off on holiday. Have a lovely time. I no longer care about anything else tennis because I am looking at Huckleberry, who is our mascot for this week, owned by Tara. Huckleberry is a 12-year-old long-haired miniature dachshund who loves carrots, destroying all stuffed toys and chasing tiny tennis balls. I love a dachshund. Billie Jean's best friend is a little dachshund called Neville. Used to be neighbours. He's now moved away. There was a reunion a couple of weekends ago and it was touching stuff, guys. It was very, very lovely. Dachshunds are wonderful dogs and Huckleberry is just gorgeous. And there'll be a picture of Huckleberry in our newsletter. What a lovely dog. I can't stop smiling looking at Huckleberry. I'm going to show a picture of him to Billie Jean. Great name as well. We have our mascots. David's got Maisie. Have your little moment, David.
Off you go. Maisie, I totally forgot all about this. But Ben Shelton not only won for himself, he won for us. And we got 150 points out of that. So thank you very much, Maisie, for your inspiration.
I've got Xenia. No need to talk about the moments of madness we had this week, Xenia. Matt's got Darwin.
Is it the aforementioned Adrian Manarino, wasn't it? Oh no, it was worse than that. It was Bartek van der Zanderschulp.
There's no need. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers. Hello to Jamie, Hannah and Drew. Thank you for being our top folks and executive producers throughout this year. And we have shout outs, Matt.
Yes, I want to just start with not technically a shout out, but just a little thank you to Meg Smith in Australia, who sent us some snacks, which we took to Shrewsbury. And all the way from Australia, they were snacks. They were from her. They were her favourite things to eat during each of the slams. And it was just a lovely, lovely thing to do, to send us those. And I wanted Megan to know that they arrived safely. And we've enjoyed them very much.
And those snacks came to Shropshire with us. And there was a moment when I thought that we now resided on the B road to Much Wenlock, when my gratitude at seeing the remnants of those snacks in the back of David's car was just immeasurably high. I thought, okay, we can survive at least for the afternoon on the remainder of those snacks. So thank you, Meg. Shout out to Matt.
Yes, we start with Lily Dennison, who is in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Right, Lily.
Hello, Lily. Like Lily Miyazaki, who was playing in Shrewsbury last week, wasn't she?
And lost to Hannah Klugman, who was the young 14-year-old player who Britain is very excited about at the moment.
Mm. Yes. Minneapolis. Got anything? I'm sure it's lovely, Lily.
Absolutely. Thank you for being a friend of the Tennis Podcast.
Thank you, Lily.
We've also got Peter Dangerfield.
Hello, Peter.
That's a great name, isn't it? Like Rodney Dangerfield.
Peter says people always ask if I'm related to Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh.
Presumably the answer is no.
He says, I always say I'm not, but when I was young, my dog was named Rodney.
Oh, love that.
That's very good. Very love good. That. Peter, like Peter McNamara, the late great Australian tennis player, who was somebody we knew and loved very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter.
And finally, we have Joey Barton, but not
do
that
we?
One.
Not that one. Not that one, no. Not the footballer who got into one or two scrapes. This one has never got into a scrape in his life and is a friend of the Tennis Podcast, to whom we can be very thankful.
Do you remember when Joey Barton went to play in France and started speaking
with a French accent. In
yeah.
English? Yes. Yeah. And then there was Steve McLaren, who went to Holland and started to do the same there.
And Joey is in Newcastle upon Tyne, one of which further complicates the shout out because, of course, Jay Barton played for Newcastle. But anyway, our Joey says he would like to dedicate this shout out to my new wife, Lucy, as we got married on middle Saturday of Wimbledon.
Oh, splendid.
Hope you had your live scores app opening during the ceremony.
And then your live from Wimbledon show to enjoy just afterwards.
What better way to celebrate happiness? Congratulations, Joey, and thank you for your shout out. I can't think of any tennis Joeys, but that makes you unique. I can think of a football Joey. You've probably heard that one before though, Joey, so I'll leave that. Thank you very much. Thank you to all our shout outs again. Shout outs, intros, pets, all of it will be once again up for grabs from early December. Watch.
Oh, shout
this
outs
space.
You can do now. Don't forget, you can still do those.
Oh yes, also. I'm terrible at the promo, David. Dreadful. Listen to David. Don't listen to me. Sign up to the newsletter, leave us a review, all of that. And we'll be back on Saturday with a 78% chance of a very special guest to preview the WTA finals. We'll speak to you then.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.